have reviewed the podcast and have not yet received a song, may this song hold you over until your day comes along.
Well done, right. Deco.
So, Caleb Porzio. Caleb Porzio.
We got to do the opener.
Welcome.
Welcome to No Plans to Merge. This is the only podcast where two developers talk about code and other things for greater than 20 minutes.
It's literally the only one. There, I've looked through the iTunes store. I've looked through Spotify. I've looked through all of them.
There are took a long time. And we're the only one. I'm Caleb Porzio, and
I'm Daniel Colburn.
Is Daniel Colburn. Oh, and that's our intro.
That is the intro. Cue the music.
D-Cole.
Meow, meow. What's up, man?
What is up?
Not much.
Yeah, not much here. Well, I'm working on LiveWire again. I took a week off.
You took a week off?
Yeah, I was working
on your week?
Meetup talk.
Yeah,
so I was working on other stuff, which is pretty cool, and I'd love to talk about that sometime.
Uh-huh.
I think it's going to be like my talk for a couple conferences this year.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you have a topic?
Yeah. Oh, a topic for today's show?
No, for your talk.
Or for the talk, yeah. Write less JS. I mean, that's sort of been my thing for the past 2 years. But I want it to be hashtag level saying, like, write less JS, like a movement.
Mm.
I have a blog post queued in my brain to write that's like the write less JS movement. And just all these tools like LiveView, LiveWire, Intercooler, I don't know, all of them, TurboLinks, Stimulus, yeah, all the things that encourage you to write less JavaScript. Yeah, so I've been going down that road a little further, and for the general development community, because like the meetup I spoke at is a full stack meetup, it's not like PHP or Laravel, so I didn't do LiveWire stuff at all. I just demoed, just walked through other techniques, just the techniques, you know.
I would never saddle you in a race against the audience, Caleb. I think that would be it would be unkind of me to do something like that, to put you in a position where you felt like you were in competition with our audience. But in this instance, I'm going to go ahead and let both you and the audience know that writelessjs.com is available.
Ooh.
So
nice. So I'll not try to purchase it until I have
until
published
we push
on the
episode live.
Yeah, until what, like 4 minutes after?
4 minutes after we push the episode live, and then you and all the audience can race for ownership of that domain.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So that's what's been up with me, and I think I might have mentioned this, but GitHub has been. I've been like sourcing all my content from GitHub, basically like source diving GitHub,
mm-hmm.
Or just like looking at GitHub's dev tools and seeing how they do stuff. Mm-hmm. And they don't write a lot of JavaScript, to my knowledge. At least they utilize a ton of techniques that, you know, like fetching HTML from the server and swapping it on the page. They use PJAX, so every time you switch a tab, it's a PJAX load. It's not any
so like
spot.
Those little modals that drop down, like,
yeah,
where it's like start a review. It looks like you added a comment. Are you trying to write a review?
Yeah. Yeah, they're all different. But some like an issues tab when you can filter issues and all those little drop downs. When you hover over those, GitHub fetches the markup for them in over AJAX, and then when you click, it's ready to go and it just toggles that markup.
Gotcha.
But there is some level of JavaScript because like the searching is live. And sometimes there's straight up, like if you star a repository, that's a straight up like AJAX request with JSON.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a total mixed bag. But I found some pretty cool things. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's good times.
Yeah, there's those filtering mechanics, man. That's one of these things. I've been doing a lot of that at work recently.
Okay.
We talked in our hooks episode. We talked a lot about the filters, modal, just displaying and hiding it, and those filter. Now the contents of that modal that I've now successfully hidden and shown, Mm-hmm. There's a lot there. We'll talk about it later. But you wrote a big blog post. I want to talk about your blog post.
A small blog post.
Small blog post, but it felt big as a personal achievement.
Interesting.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it felt like... So, listen, you're not... Since you've gone on sabbatical, I've noticed the things that Caleb Porzio does in what I think of as the Daniel hours have increased, right? I'm up. I'm looking at Twitter at 12:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
That's not normally the Caleb hours, but it's exciting to see, like, Caleb Porzio posted a blog post 2 minutes ago at 1 a.m., you know? I'm like, ah, very good.
Yeah. I ebb and flow. It's like, you know, going to bed early is, I mean, you know, of all people, like, it's hard, but it's rewarding in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you make you feel real good about yourself.
In the morning, so, you do, yeah.
In the morning, you do, yeah.
Just not right now.
Yeah. So I struggle with that on, like, maybe 1/10 of your struggle with that. But just, like, I just don't want to go to bed. Like, oh, I just have to lay there in silence until I drift off. That sounds like torture.
Mm-hmm.
When I do it, it's usually fairly okay. And I think that's where you and I differ.
Yeah. But anyway, I saw it and I was like, I just imagined you sort of like, Hannah's gone to bed, you know, you've got, what's your like preferred beverage? You like an iced tea guy?
No, I drink LaCroix. It's not actually LaCroix, but yeah.
Off-brand LaCroix.
Off-brand LaCroix, yeah.
So you've got an off-brand LaCroix. You've got your 2015 MacBook Pro with the Chiclet keys. It's late and the house is quiet. And you've got like a single reading lamp and you're just like, I'm leaving Jobs.
Yeah, that's funny. It's not too far from that. We got home late, like midnight or something.
Yeah.
I might have wrote the post at like 4 a.m. I don't know. I don't remember. But
I think it came out at like 1.
1? Okay. So I was at, we got home and it was like midnight. And we were walking in, and we live next to a restaurant. And so the little, like, alley where all the smokers smoke, we hang out with them. Like, we get to know them because they're, you know, they're smoking there, and they're there. And we always see them. We say, hey. So we've sort of established this bond with, like, the head chef at this. It's like a fancy restaurant. It's really cool. We never eat there because it's a fancy, super expensive restaurant. But he's like, hey, you guys are out late. You want to – can I get you a drink or something like that? He's like, come in, and I'll get you a drink. And we both were like, yeah, it's a good neighborly thing to, you know,
stop
accept
by.
The gift. So we did. And we just hung out with, it was like after hours. So all the restaurant, you know, staff and owners and everything, they're all just chilling at the bar and they make amazing cocktails.
That's a great party. The after hours restaurant bar party is one of the best parties.
This was my first experience. I've never been in the restaurant game at all. So you know from experience.
I do.
This is how
I love
it. Yeah, everybody's just like either like drunk, like mostly drunk, maybe definitely high, and you know, a mixed bag. Like, I mean, that's the restaurant life, like the cooks and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
It's a part of the position.
And there's this thing like you know, like in software, like if you were going to do like a huge launch, you know, like for like a week, you would like sort of build up to like, all right, now we're going to like launch this, we're going to deploy to production, and we're going to cross our fingers and hope it goes well, you know.
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah.
And then it goes well, and then everyone who like worked really hard to make that launch happen just is like, all right, like let's, you know, let's go get a beer, or like, yeah, let's, yeah, you know, whatever. It's, yep, like that
every
night
day.
Where it's just like, wow, that was insane, but we survived, like,
yeah.
let's go congratulate ourselves.
The camaraderie is just nuts. Yeah, I mean, it's like nuts. A family. I mean, you know, I've tasted it for one day, but yeah, totally. After a huge hustle, everybody's beat and they hang out at the bar and they drink for, I don't know if they drink for free or drink for free or cheap. Free or cheap. Yeah. And, yeah, so that was cool. Hung out with him for a while and had a couple drinks and then came upstairs and, you know, I'm too hyped up. Like I was just having too much fun. And I'm like, this is usually when I go on the computer and put on, I have those Philips Hue bulbs. So I put on the night vibes, like purple. So I'm helping you paint the scene.
Yep.
It's purple in the room. It's dark.
Uh-huh.
What's that, like, MacBook app that dims everything and makes it warm?
Flux.
Yeah. So my whole, you know, monitor is totally fluxed out.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually just open a code editor, like, full screen and put on some good music on my nice bassy speakers.
Yep.
And it's nice and quiet. Yeah. And then I go for it. It's at a standing desk, so I'm not touching Chiclet keys. I'm touching the Ergo Docs. But anyway, but I didn't want to do anything. Like, I've been doing that a lot lately, coming to the computer and being like, I don't want to do any coding. I don't want to, but I'm like, what could I do? And mm-hmm. I thought, well, I could write. And then this just kind of just flowed out. Yeah. And I was buzzed. So
yeah,
I think that helped it.
You know? You had like a Negroni or two running through your,
yeah, I had an old fashioned,
your brain, and an old fashioned, very close.
And a Miller High Life or High Light or whatever.
You know, back in my day, we used to say every low life needs a high life.
Ooh, I actually never had a high life before. That was my first one.
There you go.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, that seems like perfect writing conditions.
Yeah, totally. Yep.
And so, talk about the post for those who haven't read it.
Yeah, it's like a thought spew. I actually haven't read it in a long time, so I don't have a perfect impression of what it's like. But I think it was just me, like, wanting to write about how I feel about leaving my full-time job, because I still, you know, think about it a lot, and the thought process that went into it. I didn't want to write about right away because it, I don't know. Well, one, I wanted to experience it. I talked about this in the post. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it's just kind of a reflection on basically leaving jobs in general. It's a reflection on employment, I thought, and my relationship with employment and how I struggle with that relationship.
It's funny because having talked to you, like, having just been friends with you for a long time and had a podcast with you, there's a lot of things that, like, are either, like, things that, like, I know that you've thought intensely about over the last, like, year or so in there that are kind of, like, throwaway lines.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where I'm like, like, yeah. I see you making that one sentence, but that was, like, 6 months.
Yeah, that's very true. And but, I think you, yeah.
But, like, I thought it was good. Like, I thought it encapsulated all the thoughts. I think it put the emphasis in the right places. Hmm. Right? Like, you can say the same, you can hit all the same points, but if you say the right part's loud and the right part's quiet, like, I think you emphasize the things that are important and that are, like, going to be universal to people who are in this situation. And I think those were the things that I appreciated. Like, I think the way you talked about, there was a line that you had in there that was like, that's why it's a job. If it wasn't, it would be a partnership.
Yeah.
Which I think is just, I mean, you know me, I think that's just the human condition, right? Is that, like, we're all just wishing we were in a partnership, but we're stuck in a job. Just all people everywhere, from, you know, the chef at the restaurant to, you know, the CTO of Facebook, you know, whatever. Yeah. Like, I think everyone wishes that they felt that their labor was more sort of, like, evenly distributed.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that felt real important to me. I liked your uncertainty in the end, right? That like, you didn't feel like you had to, like, paint this picture of, like it's easy when you make a big decision to feel a lot of pressure to, like, retcon it into that was a great decision I made.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But it felt like you had, like, a very, like, self-aware, like, who knows if this was a good decision, and we're going to find out.
Yeah.
But it was the decision I made, and it felt right at the time, and I'm doing it.
Nice.
Yeah. That was a good post.
That's funny. You've been, like, you know, super close to me for that whole Titan journey, you know, mm-hmm. so, like, I think it's funny to hear you say that if I read it through your eyes, I would think the same thing, that those, like, he's just, like, throwing this out there in half a sentence.
Yeah, yeah.
But this was right, and other things, and I think the thing that The thing that I liked about it in hindsight was that I wrote it effortlessly.
Yeah,
so I didn't, none up. Of it, yeah, none of it was...
You didn't like calculate what should be loud,
what should be quiet. I didn't
calculate
what to emphasize and what to not emphasize. And I was pretty happy after like that the emphases were placed right, like in a balanced way. And it
you
was sort of
right
a reflection
on
myself.
Right syllable.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just like self-reflecting after that, I was like, oh, that's really cool that where I'm at right now is a balanced place.
Yeah.
That balanced enough that I could write this blog post without having to like... you know, edit the crap out of it. And, and that whole, like that whole chunk in there about, partnership, like that heavily influenced from you heavily. Like, I don't know.
This is my goal.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the things that changed me. Like when you, and I feel like I'm sure I've thought and heard and felt it before, but the way that you verbalized it so simply and obviously that like, hey, they make more money on you than you take home. Like there's no, you know.
And that's just part of a job.
Right. And that's just part of the job. That's nothing. Yeah. Yeah. So when companies, you know, do things to make you feel like you're indebted to them or they do things. It's interesting because, okay, so like Titan, for instance. They do something, no, we'll not say Titan. Let's say Spotsy. No, I don't know. To pick a company, Yahoo. You work for Yahoo.
Mm-hmm.
Yahoo implements some really nice benefit program.
Sure.
And they tell other employees, like, hey, we're giving you this fun, we're giving you a food truck stipend.
Right.
It's $1,000 a week. Mm-hmm. And everybody is so excited.
Mm-hmm.
And they reference it and they write blog posts about it and mm-hmm. everybody goes Yahoo's the best, like everybody mm-hmm. who works there gets these food truck stipends. There's this one part of me that says the usual part of me goes, oh damn, that's so cool, like that company's the best, like Basecamp. Yep. They just send their employees on these lavish vacations every year.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, like, oh, that company's the best, like that's awesome, and internally I'm sure all the employees are grateful. There's the other way of looking at it. Like, okay, well let's say Yahoo does something bad.
Right.
Like they use it as collateral in some way. Like, we do this for you or so. I can't verbalize this well. But
well, I think that like the unlimited vacation trap is like a good example, right? Like on first viewing, you're like, "Oh, like unlimited vacations. Like people can just take vacations. Like it promotes like you taking a vacation whenever you need one." We're not going to worry about counting hours, blah, 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 blah. But it quickly becomes this weird thing where, like, there's a lot of pressure to not do it. And it can be used as a way to determine that people are more or less valuable to the company.
Definitely. I mean, that I think, is separate because because it's just always bad. Like, it's separate because built into it is it puts it in the employee's hands mm-hmm. of how much to use it, and then they're taking on the pressure of, you know. And so I've worked with unlimited vacation. I think you have too. And
I have not.
You have not. Okay. It's the same thing everybody says, like, you don't take unnecessary vacation. You just don't, like, you mm-hmm. you feel that feels crazy. But so let's say like an actual benefit that is actually just beneficial. Like if they gave you like a month's vacation or 2 months vacation, you know, that would mm-hmm. be a tangible, objective benefit to the employee. At the end of the day, they're not losing money on you, you know, like they're making money on you. Like it's not a charity,
right.
You know? So there's that balance of, it's great when companies do good things for employees. That's really good.
Mm-hmm.
I think the danger is when the conception is that the company is somehow, like benevolent, you know what I'm trying to say? Like the company is beyond making money off you and into helping you in a humanitarian way.
Right. And I think there are companies that value those things, right? And the goal of those companies is often, we want to make a profit and do right by our employees, right? But there are very few companies I've ever heard of where they'll decide to do right by their employees in a specific way, lose money on it, and figure out how they're going to make that money up later.
Right, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But like, yeah, I think the point that you're trying to get at, and this is, I think, the thing that matters to me about it, is that no matter what they give you in any job, in any sort of for-profit workplace, no matter what your employer gives you, it's because they can afford to give you that and still be making a profit on you.
Right, yeah.
Right? And
that's definitely, yeah.
So the underlying thing there is, if you were able to generate as much revenue by yourself as you do within this company, you would be able to give yourself all of those things and then some.
Yeah.
Right? Because that and then some is paying for a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Right. And I think, you know, like in a certain sort of political side of the world, like there's a huge move towards either collective structures of organizations where all of the employees are the owners, so employee-owned businesses, yep. Where there is no profit to make for anyone except for the workers.
Yeah.
Which is a nice thing because you get the benefits of having coworkers and having people specialize in things, right? Like I don't, if you work just for yourself, a lot of times you have to be a generalist. You have to do sales, you have to do billing, you have to do programming. But at a company, you have the benefit of having like, this person's a project manager, this person's a salesperson. Like, and so in collectives, you have the benefits of like building an organization where people are allowed to specialize. And sometimes that can increase the amount of net revenue that you generate, the fact that you're able to specialize, while not having anyone who's sort of getting paid off of everyone else's labor.
Yeah. Or transparent. Like what, I think the thing that I'm craving now, if I were to get back in the game, if I were to make a company,
mm-hmm.
or if I were to join a company, the thing that I am after, at least I think, is transparency. Like, I'm okay with you making money off me. That's all okay. I mean, it's okay either way, mm-hmm. but I would love to like run a company where everyone knows everything, you know, yeah. where you know how much money I'm making, and I'm very direct that mm-hmm. I'm making money off you because I put this thing together. Mm-hmm. You can go somewhere else and freelance and make your own money,
mm-hmm.
but I'm making money off you. Here's how much I'm making off of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can argue with me. You can like, you can try to get more money from me,
mm-hmm.
but I'm trying to get a good deal and you're trying to get, that was another, one of these, this was a wise man at Titan once told me, you're trying to get a deal off me and I'm trying to get a deal, or like you're looking for a deal and I'm looking for a deal, you know,
mm-hmm.
like it goes both ways.
Yeah.
The employer is looking for a deal and the employee is looking for a deal. They're both looking to maximize their profit. You know?
Right. Well, and I think there's like, there's a pool of money, right? Like assuming that there's like a baseline amount of money that's like, this is what everyone needs to survive. Right. And that it's the same for the employer and the employee. Let's mm-hmm. just assume, right.
Mm-hmm.
Say whatever was like $40,000. Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's like, this is like, you can pay rent in a small apartment and put food on the table and stuff like that. Then there's this other money above the baseline of like survivability. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And employment in a large sense is two people making a case for who deserves more of that money.
Hmm.
Right. And it's like, mm-hmm. well, there's this big pile of money. It was generated by both of our effort. Often the employer's effort was largely front loaded and sort of like past effort, but they didn't get paid very well back then. And so now they have a right to sort of recoup some money for the effort that they put in the past.
Yeah.
And the employer, or the employee often is like putting in direct effort to generate these direct dollars.
Yeah.
And there's a negotiation. It's like, who deserves this stack of cash?
Yeah.
Do I deserve the stack of cash? And then I pay you like a small portion for having set up the infrastructure a long time ago? Or do you deserve the stack of cash for building the infrastructure and you give me a small portion for, you know, helping you to realize the potential of the infrastructure you built? And that's the question. And I think to your point about transparency, the only way to have a fair and equitable decision be made about that is to know how big the stack of cash is.
Sure.
And who's getting what, right?
Yep.
And this is why I've always been in favor of a percentage-based sort of profit sharing, right? I think employers tend to favor flat dollar amounts where they say, we're going to, you know, give you this dollar amount.
In salary.
I'm much more interested in saying, like, we're going to give you this percentage of the profit from every hour you work. Like, I think that would be a much better system, because then as, you know, profit goes up, profit goes down, you know, like you set a baseline of like, I need this to survive.
Yeah.
And then from the leftover money up top, I feel that I deserve 30% and you deserve 60%.
Yeah.
Right. Or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, I think a lot of people get, a lot of employees end up getting paid a lot better.
Hmm. Yeah, I could definitely see that for sure. Yep.
Sorry, I just went on a rant.
Great rant. Great rant.
I like,
this is
this stuff is, it gets in my blood.
Daniel's corner of I don't know the word. I don't want to say Marxism, but just Daniel on it. This has been Daniel on working and employment and wages.
Wages.
And there's more to come. More where that
would
came
you like
from.
To take a jump through the wage window with me?
We
need a theme for the wage the wage corner.
Yeah, so another thing that I thought as I was writing it, it's sort of this is something I hadn't thought about a lot until I started writing it and I realized that I felt this way. That employment, the sort of weird dynamic of employment where you're always sort of, you're always being evaluated and the psychological toll that that right. has, you know, like mm-hmm. there's this position of power. The employer is in this power position and they evaluate you, you know, like it seems, at least as I'm thinking right now, it seems to me so taxing on the employee. Like in hindsight, I'm thinking back and I'm looking at my life now and, you know, I haven't in burden, I haven't taken on the other taxes of actually like doing client work. So I'm a bad example for a full balanced picture of all this, but I'll just say right now, looking back, it's such a toll. Granted, I'm generally more of the striving intense type. And there's people who can roll with people who aren't as affected by somebody evaluating them as I am. But in general, it's so taxing that there you have 6-month reviews, you have check-ins, you have evaluations, you have general just this general thing in the air that's like if you screw up, the hammer's coming down. Like there'll be a private message.
Or
sent
even
to
if
you.
It's not coming down, it could come down.
It could come down, and that cloud is over everyone all the time. You know. And then somebody mm-hmm. gets reprimanded publicly or privately, and then it impacts the culture. That's it's a hard thing because I don't see a clear alternative. But I think I've just acknowledging that to myself. That's like, whoa. And when you're in that situation, you can't escape it. There's somebody playing God, and they're, you know, and you naturally. You want to rise. You want to achieve. You want to look good. You want to perform well. You want all those things, you know. And it puts the employee in this stressful and at times unhealthy. Even in the healthiest of companies, it's like an unhealthy dynamic. Call me. Check me on that. What do you got?
I think you're right. I mean, there is a lot of blood, sweat, and tears put into creating laws in this country and in particular states in this country to stop employers from just firing people willy-nilly.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are still a lot of at-will states where you can just fire people for anything. And in those states, people are more afraid. And there's correlations to people getting lower wages in places that are at-will states because they're willing to accept less to not rock the boat, right? Like, no one feels confident going into a negotiation about money when they could just get fired.
Right. Definitely.
And I think unions are the solution to that, right? The idea that to fire you, your boss has to negotiate with your union allows you to be in a much sort of safer situation where, you know, your union who represents you, who is made up of people that you elected to represent you, has a say in whether or not you get fired. Now, that doesn't mean that you can just totally screw off and do nothing, right? Because at some point, there's going to be a negotiation for everyone's salary, you know, or different salary levels. And if a union is in a bad position because of a bunch of bad apples making it appear as though people don't get any work done, then that's going to affect everyone's salary negatively. So I think everyone has an incentive there. But that's not something that a lot of software developers are open to. And so it's an interesting time in American labor.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's funny that, like, being in software development, at least in my experience, it's like the free world opposed to other trades, you know, where there's these deep roots. You know, my brother is in a union. You know, teachers union, stuff like that. Yeah, so many things are... I have zero opinion on any of this. I haven't thought about any of this hard enough to have even the slightest clue of what's best for an economy or a society. Mm-hmm. But yeah, in software, I kind of like it. I like the fact that it's all like I'm
no
not...
No rules, loosey-goosey.
There's no rules. I just love no rules always. So yeah. So in that
sense,
man.
A gold rush is fun till the gold runs dry.
Yeah, that's another thing that in it's the gold rush. So I can, in software, I can confidently say, you know, I'm unhappy with this arrangement. I'm going to leave because I can go get another job. And yeah. I think most people feel that way. Would you say?
Most people who have more than like a year or two in software development.
Yeah,
probably
sure.
Do.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. If you're like generally a good developer, have experience and all that stuff, like yeah. So that's a whole other thing.
But it's a good blog post.
Yeah, good blog post. Yeah, thanks. Cool. So that was that. That's me. What's up with you?
What is up with me? It's been a week of more React Native and more stuff. We were doing some like, so the deployment lifecycle is a little bit different in native world where you have to like build a binary and ship it. And so
can you walk me through briefly the deployment lifecycle in web is you have like everything, let's just say you're the Laravel developer with everything set up, Forge and whatever. I merge into master. And I push, and then I log into Forge or Envoyer, and I hit deploy, and then I go and I check that the code that I wrote is there and working.
Mm-hmm. So what you would do here, and when you say deploy, are you deploying to QA or are you deploying to prod?
Let's say prod.
Okay. So our situation is we haven't deployed anything to prod yet.
Okay.
We're only deploying to staging, and there's an open beta coming.
Okay.
So what we do is basically we get to the place where we want to be, we merge to master, and then someone has to pull down master on their local machine and run Expo build iOS or Expo build Android.
Gotcha.
And they build a binary, and then they push that binary up to, let's stay on iOS for now, because that's all we're really doing right now. They pushed that binary up to App Store Connect using the application loader app that exists on your computer if you have Xcode. So that pushes the binary up, and that represents a build. So then you can add a build to test flight, which is what we're doing right now.
What is test flight?
Test flight is their like beta program for apps.
Who's
so
they?
If you want people to be able to try the app before it's live in the App Store, they use test flight to do that.
Apple?
Yeah. Okay. So test flight is an app that you download.
Yeah.
And then it allows you, it's basically like the App Store, except it's like in the App Store, there's an updates tab that just shows you all of the apps that you have installed and allows you to update them. It's basically that tab of the App Store. It shows you all of the apps that you're authorized to run in test flight.
Okay.
And then you can either download and install them if you don't have them already, or update them to the latest version.
Gotcha.
Cool. So we need to have test flight for a small group of core stakeholders and like a public beta of a couple hundred people.
Okay.
And so the public beta, because it's large, has to pass through app review.
Okay.
So you push a build up in the manner I've just talked about, and then you are able to immediately assign it to your up to 25 connected users. And then they can just run it whether or not it passes review. Yeah. And then to send it out to the external users has to pass review, which I've had take 0 minutes or 2 minutes. I've also had it take 48 hours.
Gotcha.
So okay. It's just an amount of time. Yeah. And so the there's, if we need to do something like, say, on April 15th, we're going to send out a link to all of our beta testers telling them that they can join this beta. Then we have to, and that's a Monday. That was this past Monday. Then we have to basically have master in a shippable state on Friday, build the binary, push it up to App Store Connect, because we don't know how, what percentage of the weekend it's going to take for App Store Connect to pass review and all this other stuff. So it's a whole process. You basically need to know 2 days ahead of time when you're going to deploy.
That's a bummer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not fun.
That is not fun. That's like in the worst web development situations when like everything's all like Jira enforced and I forget all those regulations that forces everything to be slow and clunky and you have to take screenshots and all that stuff. It's like that, except all the time for everyone.
Yes.
Not just big clunky organizations.
Yes.
Bummer.
Anyway, it's fine. So, but what that means is that we're doing a lot of like we have a column in Trello that's like things to ship in the next beta.
Yeah.
And so it's a different style of working.
Right.
Right? Like it very much feels like a bus, yeah.
Yeah, whenever the feedback loop is slow enough, all those patterns emerge that are just they just get me.
Yeah.
They cut me deep. That's one of those huge advantages of web development, and it's good to be reminded of that. Of like nimble web development, like some web development, you know. What's possible with web development,
Yep.
Which is sweet. Cool. Did you have something to talk about?
Yeah, so this is a quick little thing.
Okay.
So the filters. Let's go back to our filters, right?
Okay.
So inside of the filter modal that you can toggle on and off with a button
in
the header.
So let's walk through this again. This is extremely confusing for me, and I imagine even more for the listener. So it's just kind of this like, so if we can at all
I'll
it down to something
and make it abstract.
Very simple.
Yep.
Yes.
So I've got a list of things. Column
tracking.
Posts. And then imagine sort of an Amazon.com style left sidebar.
Yep.
Full of filters that are going to narrow down the things
yes
in the list, right? And so it could be like manufacturer, size, whatever.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Now imagine that for each of those filters, you want to have a little bubble next to them that shows the number of items that match that filter.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Right? So it's like TVs, right? And it's like LG, 5.
Yep.
Sony, 25. Right? So you want to know, okay, so there's 5 LG TVs and 25 Sony TVs.
Yeah.
Now these, there's several types of filters. So say there's a manufacturer's one, and then there's a size one, and then there's, you know, resolution.
Yep.
Say this is TVs, right? Say each of those is in like an accordion. So it's a component that's mounting when the accordion opens.
Yep.
Right? When do you do the work of looping through all of the products that you have in memory and seeing whether or not they match, right? So doing like an array filter where, you know, TV.manufacturer equals filter.manufacturer or whatever. You know?
Yep.
There's like a filtering that needs to happen.
Right.
And what it, so basically the thing that you're going to have to do is for each filter, we're then going to have to loop through for each TV and check whether or not it matches. And if you have a long list of filters and a long list of TVs, this is a ton of work.
Yep.
And it's a ton of work that is basically queued up behind an animation.
Okay.
So if it takes a long time, what's going to happen is you're going to click the accordion and it's not going to open. And then you're going to have a bunch of thinky. And then once it figures out all the stuff, writes it into data, it's going to open and render.
Yeah.
So I've come up with a couple of potential solutions, and I'm going to write this refactor very soon. What do you think the right refactor is for this?
So stop me if I say something that tells you I don't understand the problem totally.
Sure.
As soon as you started saying it, I thought, okay, unless this is a really simple data set where you have all the JSON on the front end and you can do a pretty simple like array filter on some data in live mode, which you're saying is not the case, because I'm imagining you have to paginate these things, or that it's a huge data set and it's not just a bunch of JSON.
No, it is. It's just a bunch of JSON. We have all of the, we have a list of all of the TVs, and we also have a list of all of the manufacturers. So what needs to happen is for each manufacturer, we have to loop through all of the TVs to see if they match that manufacturer.
Yeah.
And so say we have 100 TVs and 500 TVs and 100 filters.
Yeah.
That basically works out to like 50,000 checks that have to happen in the amount of time it takes for an accordion to decide to open. So it's enough that it slows down the animation.
Gotcha. Yeah, so interesting. All right, option A, you don't block the animation and you just let the numbers... You know what would be interesting? If you didn't block the animation, but you animated the numbers like a tween from zero to whatever it ended up being, so it looked like they counted up, that would be kind of cool.
This is one of my solutions.
Oh, really? Okay. Cool. So that would be cool. The other options are eager loading. You could eager load on hover. You could start the animation or the count calculation, or you could start the count calculation as soon as the page loads and just have them all ready to go, so that when you drop down, they're just there. Or you could go farther up and eager load on the server and do like cache these filter count values and send them over with like the model or with the payload, or make it a separate endpoint. I don't know. I mean, I'm the embrace the back end guy, so I would probably go for something on the server, but you might have to deal with some cache latency or something. But what do you got?
These are my two options. This is what I'm considering.
Are there other options than I said?
No, I'm only considering two of them.
Okay.
One
the front end options.
One is a front end, one is a back end.
Okay.
So the front end option is render. I wasn't considering like the tween of counting up from 0 to 500.
Mm-hmm.
But I was basically considering load the little chiclet bubble that I'm going to load with just a dash in it,
mm-hmm.
until the count state,
yep.
is set, and then fill it.
Yeah, cool.
Which I think is probably, it's definitely the easiest,
yeah.
thing to do. The other thing was calculate all of these on the back end and pass them along with the payload.
Yep.
Where
is the filtering happening? When they filter by something, is it a pure JavaScript filter action?
Yes.
It is, okay. That impacts the solution a little bit, because if you were querying for it or something, or if the filtering was happening in the back end,
mm-hmm.
then I would say, it would make sense that it already lives back there.
Mm-hmm.
You could kind of pre-filter stuff.
But yeah, this app, like, one of the main performance characteristics of this app is to not kill the API, right?
Yeah.
Like, to do as much as possible on device, because there's so many users, like, it could turn into a
yeah.
very expensive server to run if we allowed every action to hit an API.
So these filters, like in the case of Amazon, if I search, if I make a search query for Foreman Grill Model 2, whatever, mm-hmm. and then there's the sidebar of filtering,
mm-hmm.
so I could still filter. Those numbers are the numbers that would be filtering. So if there was a filter called, like, I don't know, used, new and used, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was counts next to them.
Mm-hmm.
I would expect that those counts mean if there's 10 new, I would think there's 10 new of the query I just searched. There's 10 new Foreman Model 2s, not just
mm-hmm.
Foreman Grills or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is this a similar scenario? Because in that case, it wouldn't make, like, I wouldn't be able to eager load those numbers.
So you're saying, here, let me make it a more concrete thing.
Yeah.
So if I have selected Sony.
Yep.
And now I'm looking at the screen size filters. Should the 55-inch tell me how many 55-inch TVs there are, or how many 55-inch Sony TVs there are? Is that what you're saying?
Not necessarily, because in the case you're describing, there's a page of products and there's a bunch
uh-huh.
of filters.
Mm-hmm.
You can filter by Sony.
Mm-hmm.
And your question is, does the...
If I also filter by 55-inch.
Right. Are the filters cross-aware? Are they
mm-hmm.
aware of their other filters?
Right.
Is that the desired functionality?
That is basically V2. Right now,
that's
just V2. Saying this is how many there are total, but eventually we're
right.
going to, like, allow you to see that.
So I guess what I was saying was, if there's a search box
mm-hmm.
where the user can type anything...
Mm-hmm.
And the filter counts would have to be aware of, based on that query, it would make way more sense to do it on the front end. Because to eager load on the back end, you would be caching these very specific queries, you know?
And that's what it is, right? So the things we're returning aren't actually products. They're locations, or they're like events that happen at a location.
Okay.
And they're queried by a latitude and longitude, and we return the 500 closest to that
gotcha.
Latitude and longitude.
Gotcha. So it is the equivalent
literally
of a user typing in
a
search query.
Request.
Yeah. So you would have to do, like, the most rock solid caching. You would have to cache and eager load these counts for every latitude and longitude point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is impossible.
Yeah. Interesting. So, I mean, my gut says if it's not like... My initial reaction is do it on the front end and don't delay the animation. But yeah, add a dash. Dash is simple.
Mm-hmm.
And then they load after a second. Unless the operation is so front end expensive that, like, your app is just a bummer for people's phones.
So that's the thing. It becomes a bummer while it's doing it.
Yeah.
And that is concerning to me. So part of me wonders, should I like asynchronously batch this job as soon as I get the list of TVs back from the API?
Mm-hmm.
Should I fire an async call that like generates like a list of things, a list of manufacturers and mm-hmm. sizes and stuff, and just make a whole new data structure that's just what filters are available, what types are they, and how many things match them, and store mm-hmm. that in some sort of context or something mm-hmm. and pull it in where it's needed.
Right.
And I don't know if that's going to be more expensive or less expensive, but the idea that it's async, I mean, I guess it would be async in the other case too, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. That's interesting.
But part of me wants to say, like, why don't I take this out of this component completely and just make it a prop that's passed in, and if it's not there,
for sure, just
render it without it.
Yeah.
And then, like, basically tell the code, like, don't stress about when you get this back to me, but whenever you do get this back to me, I'm going to fill it into these spots.
Yeah. Yeah. For the front-end approach, I think that's the best approach, for sure.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if the performance is a constraint. Like, if you're going to kill batteries or it's going to feel slow.
I really wish that there was a way. Maybe there is. Maybe I don't understand JavaScript enough. But, like, I wonder if there's a way to just be, like, to, like, deprioritize a certain async call.
Oh.
You know? And be like, this is not important. You know?
Right,
like,
right.
Don't give this 100% of the CPU.
I have to believe there is. I'm the wrong guy to talk about this, but I read that React post that Dan Abramov wrote.
Uh-huh.
He goes into some crazy stuff. I mean, there's, like, in the React core, I think the new React core does some of these crazy deprioritizing stuff. Like,
that's super cool.
This just madness stuff. There's got to be a way. I think of things like request animation frame as opposed to like intervals and stuff. Like, I have to believe that the JavaScript engine at least, yeah, I have to believe that the JavaScript engine gives you some like deep tools for doing this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Or simple. Somebody listening knows. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be cool though.
It would be.
Interesting. Yeah.
I have a link to share with our listeners.
Okay.
I was listening to Syntax, Wes Boss podcast.
Yep.
And they mentioned this wonderful website called usehooks.com. It's amazing. It's recipes using hooks for all sorts of little things. So there's cool. Like, here's one called use dark mode. That's just like a recipe using hooks for like enabling dark mode on a component.
Wow.
Here's use lock body scroll to prevent your users from being able to scroll the body of the page while a certain component is loaded. So like if you had like a modal that popped up and you didn't want them to be able to scroll.
Yeah.
It's stuff like this. One of the coolest ones I heard about was use click outside. That basically,
oh nice,
anytime there's a click, it figures out, was that click on me?
Yeah.
And if it was, then it fires the on click outside handler, and if it wasn't, then it just,
or the opposite,
no, if it was on me, don't do anything.
Yeah, right.
But if it wasn't on me, do something.
Yeah.
And so that's like cool for like closing something
out,
yeah
but that's,
it's
super
just
cool.
A super cool website full of like cool recipes using React hooks. So if
sweet.
Anyone from our last crazy episode didn't figure out how React hooks work through our very obtuse, confusing explanation, you should go check out this website because it's very cool.
That reminds me of, there's a CSS website out there that's sort of similar. That's like, here are all the little annoying things in CSS. Like there's like, and it sounds exactly like that, but for CSS, there's like basic like clear fix and
nice,
other
nice, 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 nice.
other, all of those like basic things. And it's not a package. It's not anything like that.
What's
it's just
that
snippets.
Website that's just like all the things developers get wrong about time? And it's just like a list of like common developer mistakes with time.
Developers don't understand time or something like that.
It's something like that, yeah.
So, or something, yeah. Or you don't understand time. I don't remember. But yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Or how, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
But anyway, I'll report back next episode on how I ended up solving this problem. Because cool. I'm probably today or tomorrow or something going to sit down and figure it out.
Cool. Sweet. Yeah, I love those types of problems. Those the count problem with the querying and everything, like when and where to do the work.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's no clear answer. There never is. Mm-mm. But I like what you came up with. I've been so LiveWire now everything I write I TDD. That changed maybe a month ago. Yeah, I completely abandoned testing pretty quickly into it because it's just so I want to say amorphous. What does that word mean?
Like ever changing.
Really sweet. That's one of those like I don't know what the word means. I've just heard it enough times that I'm using
you did
it and you, I did it. I think I did
used
it.
A word right.
It's so amorphous. Amorphous, is that it? Amorphous. Yeah, so I couldn't like nail it down with tests, and then I'd just be maintaining these tests. So, and JavaScript testing just sucks so bad.
That's not true, but yeah, I hear you.
I think it is. Come at me, bro.
DOM testing is bad.
DOM testing is bad. True, right. JavaScript unit testing is just as easier.
Amazing.
It's just as good as PHP unit or any type of unit testing.
See also the episode Does PHP Suck? Where I talk about how much I love JavaScript testing.
Right. But inherently, like, it's the same. You're executing code and making assertions, right? Mm-hmm. The thing that makes JavaScript testing hard is when you're testing DOM changes.
DOM changes are bad. DOMs are bad.
But the thing is, what do you use JavaScript for mostly on the front end? DOM manipulation. You can't wait till what?
I can't wait till we replace DOMs. I think DOMs are old bad tech.
Like DOMs? I'm confused by your pluralization.
Document object models.
Okay, like, gotcha. Okay.
I think the DOM.
Yeah.
I think it's time for the DOM to die.
Really? What's the alternative?
I don't know yet.
Like everything's virtual DOM? Like the API you get is virtual DOM?
Like, yeah, but like I think the whole, like if you ever really get into it and you get down to the whole like XML nodes.
Yep.
It's, I mean, you're there, you know.
Yeah, I'm fine.
It's a bad, it's bad.
It's not that bad. It's not as nice as, but it, you can get children. You can get siblings.
But I feel like the, maybe this is what it is. I want the objects, the DOM objects, to be like good, well-behaved objects that have like nice methods on them and like have properties that
I mean
are
they kind of do. Like they do, right?
I want them to act like, okay, like picture like a view component, right?
Yeah.
Like you pass a view component is for all intents and purposes like a DOM node.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, like the DOM node has a __ view or whatever property.
Yeah. And it just gets, like, if you add attributes to it, those attributes are, like, just the thing dot the thing, you know?
Yep, yeah.
So it'd be nice to be able to sort of access props on DOM nodes. It would be
so
nice to be able to...
you can get attribute, you know?
I know, but you have to type dot get attribute. That's what I'm saying. Like, it's just, it feels like...
Yeah, okay, I get you.
If this is an object with properties, like, why is it not just an object with properties?
Yeah, let me think about that. It's interesting because, like, in the value example, like if you element, you document query selector an input element, and then you dot get attribute value. If there's no value attribute on the element, you'll get blank. If you dot value, you'll get the input value, no matter what. So if I type hello world into the input element and I didn't specify value equals hello world or whatever, dot value will give me hello world, but dot get attribute value will give me whatever the attribute is, you know?
Right.
Which is handy. Like there's a distinction there. So it's not as simple as just, you know, showing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think in my mind, dot value should be dot get value method.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Dot value. So you just want all the HTML attributes to be available as direct.
I don't know that that's properties. All that I want. I would not limit my request to such a small scope. What I would say is like someone who writes ES6 and who like works with component-based JavaScript, go rewrite the DOM.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And like rename all the methods and change the way we access stuff and divorce us from XML because it's like crazy. You know, like there's so much leftover like XML nonsense in HTML.
I don't deal with a lot of that. I haven't really come across that myself.
I don't know, man. It's been a while, but
yeah, you're right that it's a API that has been used and abused.
Time forgot.
Well, yeah, I mean it had to update and it has to remain backwards compatible, so naturally like PHP's like API, it's disjointed and mm-hmm. verbose and not consistent. But yeah, it is weird. One of the weird,
but
like when you
it's based on JavaScript, right?
Okay.
That's the thing, right? And so JavaScript's API was like that for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's good. Now it's JavaScript,
better.
Very
it's
good
better.
API.
Pretty good. Better.
Pretty good. Pretty good API.
Is there a simple way that you can think of? No, forget it. Go on. Keep going.
And so I think it's just time for the DOM to get this the like ES6 treatment.
That would be fun. That would be very fun if there was like if like Babel could handle DOM stuff. If there was like Babel but for DOM, so that we just had this really killer API to do stuff easy.
Because jQuery was bad in a certain way, right? But we moved away from jQuery.
Why was it bad?
It wasn't good for like writing applications in.
Because it's all event driven and you just
because the DOM was your state management library.
Right. Yeah.
But so we moved away to these sort of component based frameworks, right? And like now we get to do like serious programming in the front end, which is cool and nice. But we did lose like our connection to the DOM that back in the jQuery days, like I could just like grab the DOM and do stuff and like it was really easy because jQuery basically wrote a nice API on top of the bad DOM API.
Yeah.
So when we lost jQuery, when we lost jQuery, we gained a lot in like our ability to write good code, but we also lost the only good DOM API that we ever had.
Yeah.
And so now it feels like, all right, well, like let's build a good DOM API that like fits inside of these like new modern coding practices that we have, you know?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. We've lost touch with the DOM using things like JSX and we've totally lost touch with the DOM. That's a shame. Or not, I don't know. And jQuery, like you said, like the DOM is the state management library. I think if I had written jQuery and I had used the DOM as a state management library, then I would have been much better off and you could probably still do pretty well. Like Stimulus does that. Stimulus stores all, like it, that's its thing. It's like store the state in data attributes.
Mm-hmm.
But most people didn't do that. Like you kind of stored state in random global variables and just like listened to clicks and listeners or whatever. And wrote handlers for stuff, and you got in that like callback listener hell. It was just so unstructured.
Yep.
But DOM API, I agree with you. There should be something that we can just pull in that gives us like better DOM. Something
like when you do like even in Vue, like sometimes you drop down and now you're in raw DOM land.
Yeah.
You know,
usually like in the created method or something,
or like an event.target situation.
Sure.
Like
yeah,
if you're handling an event,
right?
And you'll end up with like, oh, now I have an XML node, like shit, what does this do?
Yeah.
What abilities do you have, XML
well,
node?
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about, this XML node thing. Usually I get element node. That's the
I'm trying to remember what the context was for this. I think it might have been when I was working on building a markdown editor. Was the time where I like encountered XML nodes so hard. And it was basically like, you know, I'm typing and I'm rendering as though I was typing in this box, but really I'm rendering things parsed through something else.
Maybe anyway, it's
there's like text nodes. There's different types
of text nodes, element nodes.
Yeah. And they're different and they all have different APIs and different abilities.
They do. Now, that is somewhat annoying. And the way to check if it's an element node is the way I check in LiveWire is I take the node and I do node dot, or I do type of node dot, what is it? Some function that's only available in element nodes.
Mm-hmm.
So I say like type of if type of not equals function.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Or maybe undefined or something. I think I do it not equals function, then, you know, return out of here, which is my way of filtering out all text nodes and only getting element nodes.
That type of stuff, like,
but you like get first child, there's like first child and then there's first element node child or element child, which is nice. It's like, oh, I don't know. I've been using the DOM API a ton and
You're definitely closer to it than I am.
Yeah. And it's sometimes it sucks and sometimes it's fine. The classless API, like there's improvements, you know, like the classless API, and you can get like, if you wanted to get CSS stuff, like style information from HTML before, that was a total nightmare if you were getting computed styles, you know, like the style that gets applied to an attribute, not the style tag. Like that was a nightmare, but now we have computed style APIs. I don't know. There's so many fun new APIs that are like really well done. Here's one. Emitting an event, emitting a DOM event in JavaScript. Mm-hmm. I dare you to emit a click event without dot click. So emit like a custom event on an element. It's terrible. It's like the kind of thing you Google, you find the Mozilla docs, you copy and paste the thing, and you're still like confused and frustrated.
I love the Mozilla docs.
I do too.
That's probably the greatest single contribution to programming out there.
Yeah, that's a good one. I forget, like I just blur it and forget that it's Mozilla. I just am like, oh, this is JavaScript docs.
Yeah, but it's not. It's like not the official doc.
Right. Are there official docs?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
They're bad.
It's always W3 schools and Moz.
Well, W3 is like the official definer of what is JavaScript.
Okay. Mind blown. Is W3 the official docs? No way.
Yeah, for HTML. Well, so the W3, the World Wide Web Consortium.
Right. W3C.
Right.
I thought that was different than W3 schools. I thought W3 schools
is a project of the W3C, which is like the education initiative of the W3C.
Yeah. Came up on W3 schools. You?
Sorry? Oh, yeah. Well, that and a couple other websites. But yeah, it was big.
Yep. That's what
I still remember, like, yeah, just learning the basics, like LIs and stuff.
I got a fun one for you.
Mm-hmm.
Two fun ones. Here's a fun one. One of the APIs of JavaScript that I adore is string APIs. String API. Dot match and dot replace.
All about them.
And regex is that you don't have to wrap in quotes. They're just it's an actual thing. Awesome. Dot replace, this is my new favorite thing. I've used it twice in the past day. So if you're doing string, like, so you have a string literal in JavaScript. Like,
yes.
So the thing I was doing was converting dot notation to a different type of notation. So I'm searching for dots inside of a string. If I do have the input string, like it's Daniel.Caleb, and then I do dot replace, and I pass in a regex and look for all periods or whatever, then I can pass in a string, and it'll replace all of those periods with the string I passed in, right? Simple enough, super simple. But so many times I need more than that, you know? Like, in my case, I wanted to get all
Can you pass a callback function?
You can pass a callback function! And the first parameter is the matched string, like you'd expect. The second parameter, and so on, is all the matched groups. Is all, like, any groups you put, they come in as parameters. So you can name them super easily, by naming your callback arguments. And then the last one's like the offset it occurs on if you need to do specific like substringing.
Yeah.
And then the last one's something else. I don't know. And then you just return the string that you want to replace it. Like it's the missing link for me. For some reason, like this is, it's the missing link.
Beautiful.
Yeah. It's so nice. So I've been using
it. I wonder how much of Ziggy I could replace with that.
It's sort of a Swiss Army knife for me now. It's like, whoa. Regex just got that much better in JavaScript.
Most of Ziggy is string.replace regex this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like most of Ziggy.
Cool.
The hard parts.
Yeah. Oh, I should check out Ziggy because you probably do a lot of like, interesting, maybe not. Forget I said that. Like, do you have to parse dot notation yourself or you wouldn't, right?
Yeah.
Because that would be the name, the route name.
Yeah, the route names are already keyed in dot notation, so it doesn't matter. But yeah, I parse slashes and stuff like that.
The bummer I'm coming across is that in Laravel, you can use data get or array get and use dot notation to access deeply nested properties. In JavaScript, you can use dot notation as well on objects. That's how you access properties. But you can't access a numeric index, right? You can't, So you have to convert, like, dot, if it's dot and then a numeric key, I have to convert that into the array notation. Yeah. Yep, and that's when I used that. So that's a fun little nug.
Man, you're having all the fun problems.
Dude, so many. Can I tell you one more?
Yeah, one more.
One more. So, one more. Then you have to go to bed. So I sourced Dove Live View, Phoenix Live View.
Cool.
It's JavaScript side.
Cool.
Phoenix Live View's JavaScript is one file. I kid you not. I don't know if it's processed or bundled or anything. It's just one file. It's one file with like a handful of classes.
Why do you think that is?
Less JavaScript than LiveWire.
Because,
way less.
Because Elixir is more, is giving it more of what it expects, and so it has to do less custom stuff.
One reason, yeah, is that...
Or because it just does less stuff than LiveView does.
Both.
Or than LiveWire does.
Both. It just does less stuff. It also... LiveView is so powerful, like, in itself with WebSockets and its Elixir integration. There's so many things that are just impossible, at least that, to my current eyes. That I have to compensate for with JavaScript
code. Watching you. Yep.
So anyway, but I found this technique. These are the kinds of things that you need to read other people's code to learn. To learn, you know, like I would have never thought of this. So in LiveWire, we could just say in Vue.js. I don't know. We'll say LiveWire. Here it comes. In LiveWire, you have a component, right? A LiveWire component. And in it, you have wire colon click, right? To listen for a click. Just like in Vue, you have an at click handler. When that click happens, you have to know, you have to fire that action or do something on the component, right?
Right.
So what I do, when I load the component, I tree walk. I walk through all the DOM nodes, and I look for those click handlers, and I attach listeners to them. That's what you think. That's the declarative way, or that's imperative. Like I'm going through node by node. I'm looking for an attribute. If I see it, I'm attaching an event listener. Right?
Okay.
Phoenix LiveView does not do that.
What do they do?
They use bubbling. They use what already exists in the browser. Where if you
click, just attach a click handler to the top element
to window. They do window.addEventListener, and they listen to any event on the window. And then they get the target from the event, which is the source, the element that started the event, the one you clicked. And then they find its closest parent with the, with like the component ID or whatever. So they crawl back up the DOM tree.
So they're crawling up, you're crawling down.
Right. And there's so many benefits to crawling up than crawling down. Like when you get into nested components, it gets absolutely...
I thought there were no nested components, Caleb Porcia.
I'm putting them back in.
I was led to believe that nested components were a thing of the past.
They're still gone, but I'm putting it back in. They have to be in there.
Yep, I agree. I re-listened to the episode the other day. I was in the drive-thru of a Zaxby's.
Okay.
We
don't have those, but I've seen
Zaxby's is a very good fried chicken restaurant in the South.
Sweet.
And I was in the drive-thru awaiting my Zax sauce. And I was listening to the part where you stripped nested components out.
Yeah.
And I was listening to myself just be like, oh, I was like, wait a second, I should have fought him. Like,
not okay.
Nested components need to be in this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway.
They're coming back. But they're imagine that, like, things get really tough when you're...
when you've got handlers and stuff.
Like, LiveView, what LiveView can't do is do, like, I have loading directives where if you click on something, you can... there's these nice little wire loading directives where you can, like, show a loading spinner or something. Sure. Stuff like that is impossible. Yep. Or at least I can't see how to do it in that paradigm. Yeah. Anyway, there's so... I would love. We should have a completely separate podcast just for LiveWire problems and solutions. And
I think this is that podcast.
This is the podcast.
We just need to decide on a given episode. We're just going to talk about problems and solutions today.
Yeah.
Maybe next week. Next week we'll just go in.
I mean, it could be hours long, but we should. That would be fun to do.
Just do a couple episodes.
Just a couple episodes.
Buying them out.
That's right. All right. DeCole.
Good talk.
Good talk, buddy.
I just knocked something over on my desk. Whatever.
Whatever.
Good podcast.
All right. Good podcast. TTFN.